Welcome to Pride Pulse, the podcast where we celebrate diversity, amplify voices from the LGBTIQ plus community, and dive deep into the issues that shape queer life in South Africa. I am your host, Iviwe Mzandisi. And in today's episode, we are unpacking the state of queer rights. South Africa is known for its progressive constitution when it comes to queer rights, but legal protection doesn't always translate to social acceptance. In this episode, we'll be discussing the ongoing legal and social challenges faced by the LGBTIQ plus community, both here and across the African continent. Joining me for this important conversation is human rights advocate and legal expert, Mutlatsi Mwitswile, who has dedicated over a decade to advancing equality and inclusion in various sectors. So today I wanted to look at, right, legality.
Okay.
Legality, that big word, you know, the legalness of it all. Mm-hmm. Let's start with legal framework. South Africa is often seen as like the beacon of like of hope, like, oh, our constitution is so, the best in the world. Yes. We are so cemented, we are so protected constitutionally, but like on the ground, it's a different story, mm-hmm. right? Could you provide an overview of where South Africa stands legally regarding queer rights?
Okay, so I think the first place to start is the Constitution. The Constitution as promulgated in 1996, which has a section known as the Equality Clause. That's Section 9 of the Constitution. And that's where it provides that we are all equal before the law. And as citizens, in fact, as people in the country, we may not be unfairly discriminated against on various grounds, but some of those grounds include sex, gender, sexual orientation, race, marital status, and so forth. And from that basis, or rather from that clause, then flows various other legislation, such as the Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act, such as the recently promulgated Hate Crimes Act. I mean, you could even think of BEE as an act that flows from, you know, that section. So ultimately, obviously, the Constitution is the foregrounding law for all laws in the country, because we are a constitutional democracy. And then from there on, various government departments and entities then have to find implementing laws that then inform the kind of actions they must take to give effect to what's in the Constitution. And that's where you then find these various laws, including just as well, important to mention, the Civil Unions Act, which then allowed, or rather provided, that same-sex couples could now enter into legally recognized marriages. You also have what's known as the Alteration of Sex Description Act, which gives intersex and transgender individuals the right to be able to approach departments like the Department of Health and the Department of Home Affairs to change their gender marker. So there's various pieces of legislation emanating from the Constitution that then inform the kind of protections that we are afforded. And that's what the legal status is. And yeah. Like you said, of course, the reality is that not everyone, one, is aware of those laws and how they should access them. And by everyone, I also mean that the people who must give effect to them. So not all government officials are aware that these are the laws that are there and how they must give effect to them. So you have that disjuncture between what citizens expect or desire and what the government is able to provide.
And what would you say is, I mean, 30 years of democracy, what would you say is like hindering that process, everyone getting on board, like, this is it, guys?
I think that the challenge is one where LGBTQ people are concerned. We are a minority. I know as a queer person myself, we often think that there's more and more and more and more of us. But then in the reality of it, we are a minority in the broader sense. We are a country of 60 million. And at last check, there's about less than 10 million at least known queer people, queer identifying people. But then again, those numbers are not consistently collected. So, you know, I also speak under correction. But the understanding is that we are a minority. Yeah. As a result, our rights often don't get prioritized unless we get up and we say we are subjected to this kind of discrimination and needs to be addressed. You know, when you think of the issue of marriage equality, it took a couple that wanted to get married. Not that LGBTQ people or same-sex couples had not been getting married socially, but then there was a couple that then decided that they were getting married socially, but then also wanted the legal protection that came with that, and then they went off, went over a near 8-year, I believe, legal battle to get, you know, to ultimately get their marriage recognized, but also ultimately ended up with everyone who then wanted to get married to have their rights recognized. So there is that. There's also just the lack of political will from our politicians and government who don't prioritize issues of minorities, not just LGBTQ people, but various minorities will find that the various rights that they believe they are, you know, guaranteed in the Constitution, they don't actually get to live until someone gets up and says, I've tried to access this particular service, or I was treated in this particular way when I was accessing a particular service, and that is wrong because the Constitution says 1, 2, 3, 4, and I need redress. And when you have options or resources to access redress, that's when you then start seeing things change and seeing things happen. And often enough, people don't know that they can actually act against the government when you're not, when you've not been given what is due to you, what is guaranteed that you're entitled to. And often people then just walk away. You go to a hospital as a trans person, for instance, and you want hormonal therapy, and you're told, no, you can't get that. And you're not given a reason why that is the case. And people don't know that they can actually take action against government for things like that. So I think the challenge is being able to ensure that citizens know what their rights are in their fullness. And if they are not provided what is guaranteed to them as per their rights as guaranteed in the Constitution or the law, broadly speaking, then where do they go? You know, if you don't get what you need from the Department of Home Affairs, who do you approach? From the hospitals, from the police, you know, various government departments, or in fact, even if you are mistreated in society, who do you approach? Who do you go to ensure that that wrong act perpetrated against you gets corrected? And a lot of people don't know that in our country.
You know, it's quite disheartening to hear, you know, but I think you've been able to highlight the work that still needs to be done and just to identify those gaps. But like when we look at the role of advocacy, right, in this context, how do human rights lawyers and activists help bridge the gap between legal protections and social acceptance for the queer community?
One of the things that I've always said as one a human rights activist is that, and secondly as a lawyer, is that we often think of lawyers as being a special category of people and not necessarily subjects of the broader societies that we live in. And equally so, various people, police officers, doctors, nurses at public hospitals, teachers and so forth, we are all part of the bigger society that we all live in. And if we are to accept that we live in a society that is, one, foregrounded or conditioned under patriarchal terms, everyone is subject to the same conditioning. There isn't a situation where, as queer people, for instance, we are set aside and we are told, well, you are queer and therefore you should, you know, not be subjected to this kind of conditioning or normativity. And equally so, it goes for women, women of all kinds, trans women, lesbian women, cisgender, heterosexual women, black, white, Indian women. Everyone is subject to the same kind of conditioning in society. And equally so, lawyers, even though lawyers work with the law and understand the law and how it can be applied, they're also subject to the same community. So that is why it should not be shocking. Disappointing it might be, but it should not be shocking if you encounter a lawyer who's homophobic, queerphobic, transphobic, a lawyer who's not pro-human rights across the board. They may be the best lawyer, but then they're also subjects of the same community, the same society that we live in. That being said, though, there is a place for lawyers who, one, might themselves be queer like myself, who understand and are pro-human rights, they're pro-queer rights particularly, and want to take a stance to drive the movement of achieving more inclusion, more acceptance, more tolerance, and a transformation of societies, broadly speaking. And I think there is an opportunity for various lawyers, whether they be advocates, attorneys, or lawyers working within different organizations, to make their voices heard, make their voices known, and take a stance and start taking action. In fact, particularly in my particular situation right now, I'm undertaking a process called pupillage. For those who might not understand, it's training for, you know, when you want to become an advocate in South Africa as a member of the various bars, or rather various associations of advocates, you undertake training to become an advocate, and it's called pupillage. I've been undertaking that process. And it's now coming to an end, but I've now just formed part of a group of advocates made up of some of my peers who are going through the same process and others who've already been advocates for the longest time, who've said we've worked as advocates for a long time and we've taken cases on for a long time, but maybe it's time for us to come together and act in concert or as a collective and start, one, transforming the legal profession so that not only do queer or LGBTQ identifying advocates know that this is a profession that understands them, that is safe and is inclusive, but also the communities that we serve know that we are also available to be at their aid. We are available to take up the cause for achieving inclusion in broader society and realizing the rights of the marginalized. So I think there's an opportunity, not just for advocates, but also for society to start saying, why are we not getting the support or the access to legal services that can help drive us forward?
You know, when I think, taking what you said into account, it made me think back to a conversation I was having with Dr. Bevdi.
Yes.
And we were just talking about looking at South Africa compared to Africa and like the difference, the ghastly difference, you know, the ghastly difference between the two. How does South Africa compare to other countries regarding queer rights when we like look at like Africa?
I mean, as you said when we started, South Africa is often seen as being this beacon or a leader where it comes when it comes to queer rights. We are still the only African country that gives same-sex couples, you know, protection to enter into marriages. We are still the only African country that has in its constitution that outlaws unfair discrimination on the basis of gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity. We are still the only country where same-sex couples, whether married or not, can adopt children, you know, have benefits, you know, when your partner is employed, you have a right to claim from, you know, when you separate, for instance, you can claim for maintenance and so forth. So we've got, on paper, we are a shining light as a country. But the reality of it is that we are a country that is still quite highly conservative. And as a result of that conservatism, you have a lot of homophobia, queerphobia, transphobia. You have a lot of xenophobia in the country. That xenophobia exemplifies or manifests itself, particularly so when you have African, South Africans who are from African countries who come into the country seeking asylum or refuge because, for instance, you're from Nigeria or from Uganda, where those countries have been debating, or Ghana, where they've been debating and have made a move towards legalizing homophobia in the form of anti-homosexuality legislation. And they come to this country because we are known as a country that can be safe for them to be LGBT identifying publicly, so even privately, but they know that their human rights, where their gender and don't have that protection once they come here. So we might have the laws, but then the reality is that those laws are not as accessible to everyone. You have to be quite privileged to enjoy the full breadth of the legal protections that are provided in this country. And that's quite disappointing. And it's a shame that we are in this country that is known the world over for having this amazing constitution. But then when you live in this country, whether you are South African, whether you are not South African, but living in this country, it's often just about sexual orientation where you are economically will be protected.
You can actually,
but the reality is that the full benefits of the constitution, because if you are, let's say, in a higher LSA, you are able to, for instance, you might know a lawyer who's able to assist you when you've been wronged or have not been able to get access to a certain law. Or you might not even have a friend, but you know where to go. The average person who lives in a township in South Africa, or lives in a rural area in South Africa, doesn't have in their immediate periphery access to those resources, or doesn't even know anyone who might say, this is where you need to go. And I think that also then speaks to the inability, not just of those resources, but of the media, of our schools, of our government institutions, for actually disseminating that information to the broader public.
Looking at like your work and your experience like over the years, because your bio is stacked, boo-boo. Your bio is stacked. Are you seeing progress in terms of, like, the groundwork is getting there slowly but surely? We are trying to fill in those gaps.
About 8-9 years ago, I was part of an initiative. I worked with the Tamidis Foundation, and we did dialogues across the country. Mm-hmm. What we did was we went into rural, very deeply rural and sometimes township communities across the country. I remember we did a dialogue in Gurman. We did a dialogue in Putadichaba. We went to some parts of Limpopo, some parts of the Northwest, very far-flung parts of Mpumalanga. And we got into those communities and we were speaking to people about being LGBTI, the experience of LGBTQ people in those communities, not from what we know them to be because we're from Gauteng, but what those people's experiences were in those communities. And often you'd find people saying, I did not know until you guys came into a community what it was being transgender. For this entire time, I thought I was a butch lesbian. Or for this entire time, I thought I was a femme gay man. But now you've opened my eyes. And I think actually you've educated me. You've given me the language and you've given me a direction of where to go in terms of identifying myself. And this is just at a personal level for them. But then beyond that, people in those communities often didn't know that as a trans person, they were entitled to going to Home Affairs and actually being able to change their gender marker. They didn't know that if they go to a police station and report a domestic violence case or report being raped and they're treated wrongfully by the police officers, they could actually take action against those police officers. In most instances, they just turn back home and never say anything about that. They didn't know that they could go to a health facility and actually access healthcare that is adequate and needed to be sensitive to their individual circumstances. And I think when I look at communities today, I take pride in the fact that people have knowledge of that. But I also take acknowledgement of the fact that not everyone was in those rooms when I was in those places. And not a lot of people undertook the same kind of work to ensure that that knowledge continues to permeate in those communities. So there's a lucky few, and it's disappointing to even say that, a lucky few who were able to be in those rooms, be aware that there's this kind of work and be able to know that there's various resources that they can access. But then there's a queer person who was 10 in 2016, 2017, and now is, 18, 19, 17, and they're dealing with, puberty. They're dealing with becoming, you know, a young adult. They're dealing with accessing the world. And more often than not, they think that they need to run to the biggest city centers. They need to come to Gauteng. They need to go to Cape Town in order for them to be as queer as they want to be, to access community, to access resources. And it doesn't need to be that way. So I think it's, one, good that there are people who are undertaking the work and often invest themselves in visiting those communities. But then it's disappointing that the services are not as near to those people, so that people don't always feel like they need to come to Gauteng or go to the Western Cape in order for them to be able to get those services. And it's disappointing more so that government hasn't invested itself still in being as accessible as possible, whether through communication, whether through setting up centers that are accessible to, you know, those communities. It's also quite sad, and I say this as a lawyer, that we don't have more and more lawyers who have an interest in taking a public interest litigation that then forces government to do what government should be doing, and that is to do right by queer people across the country.
And have you ever dealt with like a case that just broke your heart?
I have, but I also can't give details of some of the cases. I mean, as a lawyer, I have, and I can't give details of those cases. I'm actually part of a case earlier this year that was an immigration case, and I can't give further detail in it because it's ongoing. But I have. I think, though, as a queer person, I've encountered more heartbreaking stories as an activist who's not particularly present in those spaces acting as a lawyer, but rather as someone who's passionate about the equality and inclusion of, you know, LGBTQ people. Experiencing trans people, for one, who are from very rural areas, saying, I have to come to Gauteng every month to access HRT, and it's a big expense on me. Or someone who is in rural Eastern Cape saying they need to go to Cape Town for them to access hormonal therapy. And no one is thinking about making that service as, you know, accessible as possible for people in those situations. Hearing about LGBTQ teenagers in high school being bullied by not just, you know, fellow pupils and learners, but by teachers as well, and not getting protection from the leadership in those schools, and ultimately being, you know, faced with two choices, either to continue living with the bullying until they leave high school or dropping out of school. That ultimately means that this person might never go back to school, and literally, excuse my French, but fucks up the entire life. Mm-hmm. Because you drop out of school, you don't get matric, you don't get access to university, your chance of economic participation are then, you know, diminished quite mm-hmm. greatly. When you think about the reality of South Africa with a massive unemployment challenge, youth unemployment challenge, yeah. if you are queer even, you are then going to be faced, if you are queer and you've got a degree, for instance, you have chances to work, but then you are faced with homophobia, queerphobia. So if you drop out of school, it's almost over for you. So I think it's hearing of stories like that that has broken my heart and encouraged me to, one, pursue activism work, but also place me where I am right now, to want to become a practicing advocate who might engage in that kind of work and that kind of litigation.
You know, you spoke so eloquently about access and how, like, people in the rural areas might not have access to, like, resources. And that's, like, a great point. Outside of, like, access, is there other ways that government can intervene in terms of, like, disseminating information, perhaps through media?
There's lots. I mean, the first thing is schools are not a safe place for queer kids. And like I said, you get bullied when you go to the bathroom. You get bullied by a teacher for expressing yourself in a particular way. You get bullied by the system once you start identifying in a particular way that will not protect you and afford you the right to identify as you identify.
Yeah.
Ultimately, kids are in school to learn. And if they are intent on learning, they should be afforded the opportunity to learn. How you identify has no material effect on how, you know, on your ability to learn
yeah.
or your ability to absorb what is being taught to you. And ultimately, queer kids often find themselves having to drop out of school because that is an issue. You know, you come to school as a gay boy, or rather, let's say you come to school as a trans kid, and then you are forced, you are boxed in a particular way. Mm-hmm. You go to the bathroom as a queer kid, whether gay, lesbian, trans, you're going to be bullied on your way to and when you get to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. That makes the schooling experience horrible. And the easiest way to avert that or to address that is, one, starting with teacher education. Teachers are not educated within their schooling as university students when yeah. they're becoming teachers. They're not, one, they're not taught how to deal with issues of diversity and inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
If they are, it's not adequate. Secondly, once they come into school, life orientation curriculum also does not have expansive content that deals with LGBTQ identities. Mm. And that's a problem, because then you're dealing with teachers who are inept in dealing with this situation, learners who are also from a patriarchal society, homophobic society, coming to the schooling environment who are not given information that addresses that or counters that sentiment. So the first place, I think, the biggest opportunity is within school. Transforming curriculum, transforming teacher education, transforming school environments across the board, and making it compulsory that kids from a young age start engaging with diversity in sexual and gender identity. Secondly, hospitals. Hospitals, police stations, and other public institutions yeah. are a horrible place for most LGBTQ people. You go to a police station to report a domestic violence situation, an assault, and the first thing that happens, you walk in and people see you in a particular way and expect you to behave in a certain way. Then you're secondarily victimized. Yeah. And then that discourages you. You leave the police station, you go and you tell people, the next person who gets assaulted, gets raped, is bullied, etc., will be afraid or reluctant to go to a police station to then, you know, have their matter heard, have,
yeah.
you know. And when that happens, obviously, it means those issues don't get escalated. They never reach court. You'll never have a situation where you are in court and you're dealing with a gay man who's been raped and says, I was raped because I'm gay, or a lesbian woman who was raped and luckily isn't killed. And it's actually horrendous to even say that it's lucky that she's not killed, but isn't killed, and therefore their case actually gets to court. We might see a change in that because now we have the Hate Crimes Act as law, but then previously, you could, even if you actually get to court, the fact that you are queer, which played a big role in you being violated, was never a factor that get considered in the investigation and even in court in prosecuting the matter. So I think, one, it's in transforming the existing situations, the existing services, and ensuring that those who render those services, those who oversee those services, are sensitized to the realities of queer people, to how to deal with queer people as clients or victims and so forth. And then from then on, making sure that resources that then they need can be availed. But until you've transformed service provision, you can't then go and say, let's provide resources that deal with the aftermath when you haven't transformed the first entry point, so to speak.
You know, before we wrap up, what practical advice can you offer to our listeners, whether they're allies or part of the community, to support the ongoing fight for equality?
That's a big undertaking. I think there are many opportunities. Mm-hmm. Like I said to you earlier, I have been undergoing training to become an advocate. In conversations with different, you know, peers and seniors, there was this agreement that the legal profession has a role to play in transforming our societies, transforming the profession itself, but also societies. What do we do about it? And a lot of people often stop at, we have problems. They never take it further and say, what can we do about those problems? I, for one, like I said, I'm now part of this group. What do we intend to do? We intend to, one, start with advocating for a transformed legal profession that then might be able to take up more cases that address violations and, you know, discrimination against LGBTQ people. That's one aspect. I spoke again earlier about the work that I've done with the Tamidis Foundation. There's still tons and tons of opportunity to go into our communities. People in those same communities can take up, you know, actions that drive for transformation, that ensure there's education, to ensure that there's change. Young people, we've seen amazing young people at different schools rising up against the Fees Must Fall movement, for instance. Young people at schools rising up against racism in their schools. Queer students need to become, and it's sad to even say, but they also need to become activists for change in their immediate communities, in their schooling communities, and not just by themselves. Discrimination isn't a discrimination because it exists on its own. It's not isolated. A homophobe is most likely going to also be a racist. They're most likely also going to be sexist. So the lesson is also to not think that you are alone, and to also not operate as if you are alone, but to start forming alliances with other people and then moving together in concert. So there is an opportunity to form alliances with movements that are directed at gender equality for women, movements that are still geared towards achieving racial parity, and other movements. So I think the biggest advice or the biggest encouragement I can give is that there's still opportunity, there's still work that needs to be done, and that work is on the back of the amazing laws that we have. Those amazing laws that we have still need people to stretch them, to test them, to call for their, you know, to say that this law is actually inadequate. It still needs more. Let's improve on it. Or this law actually has never been tested to its fullness. What happens in this instance, in that instance, in that instance? And then that's when you then see that, is this law actually doing what it was meant to do? And in those instances, that's when we are able to say, actually, the law is inadequate. Let's change it. But until citizens rise up and say, these laws are inadequate, or these laws are not doing everything that they were actually saying that they were meant to do. If a law says it's supposed to address unfair discrimination on the basis of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you realize that actually 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 has 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, 2.1, 2.4. And until we get there with the law, it will always be assumed that the law is enough. But if people start saying, poking holes at the law and actually questioning it, then that's when you see that it's inadequate. And that work doesn't only require lawyers, it also requires citizens. Lawyers don't come up with cases. It's people who actually come to lawyers and say, I've been violated in this way, or I need this kind of assistance. And that's when we then, as lawyers, step in and say, let's start poking holes at this law and then start seeing the best way we can approach government to then say, this is actually, you know, an inadequate law. Let's improve on it.
You know, Mutlatsi, thank you so much for sharing your insights and your experience. It's been an enlightening conversation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I hope, one, this will educate people, but secondly, encourage people to, even at an individual level, to start saying that the law needs to be accessible to them at an individual level, but at a collective level. And if they feel like it's not, to start making noise about how inaccessible it will be. I think that's the easiest way for us to start making noise about changing the law to make it more accessible in areas where it's not.
Thank you for joining us on this special episode of Pride Pulse. A special thank you to our guest Motlatsi Moitswile for sharing his expertise and perspective on the ongoing fight for queer rights in South Africa and beyond. Until next time, stay proud and prideful.